everybody. I'm Karen Hartglass, and it's time for another It's All About Food here on September 2nd, 2014. Did you have a nice Labor Day weekend? What did you do? I labored. I always labor, but I love my work, so it's okay to just work and work because my work is what I do. Right, and gosh, I have been just praising the weather here in New York all summer, how wonderful it's been, and I think the real New York summer weather has finally arrived. It's been hot and humid, and there's nothing that will keep my hair from going up vertically. It's just all over the place with this humidity. I hope you're staying cool wherever you are. Let's bring on my first guest. I'm really looking forward to speaking with Lisa Kemmerer. She's a philosopher activist dedicated to working against oppression, whether on behalf of the environment, non-human animals, or disempowered human beings. Her books, and there are many, include In Search of Consistency, Ethics in Animals, Animals and World Religions, Sister Species, Women, Animals, and Social Justice, Call to Compassion, Reflections on Animal Advocacy, Speaking Up for Animals, an Anthology of Women's Voices, and Primate People, Saving Non-Human Primates Through Education, Advocacy, and Sanctuary. Lisa has hiked, biked, kayaked, backpacked, and traveled widely, and is currently Associate Professor of Philosophy and Religions at Montana State University, Billings. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, how are you today?
Good. I'm so happy we finally made this happen.
Yeah, me too. Thank you for your patience.
Well, thank you for your time. And so let's talk about you. So my first question is, what inspired you to do the work that you do, working against oppression?
Wow, what a question. It's huge. I think that from my experience, people who tend to work for social justice have a lot of things in their own past that have made them aware of injustice.
Yeah. Some, you know, I don't like to say the ends justify the means, but often something happens that motivates us to, and I don't know your history, that motivates us to do better and to, so other people don't have to experience what we've experienced or anything like what we've experienced.
Yeah, and you know, we don't have to say the ends justify the means because it wasn't intentional. These are things that happened in our past that we had no say over. And the question becomes, what will we do with them now, to bring a better world?
Mm-hmm. I like that. That's part of how we manage our past, realizing that we weren't responsible for some of the things that happened. And now that we are responsible, we can make things better.
Exactly so. And, you know, you say that just yesterday. I was talking to somebody about ends and means in organizations and how some of them do use the idea that the ends can justify the means and will even with the idea of infighting in among groups trying to bring change. This is one of the things that brings a tremendous amount of fighting is those who think that the ends do justify the means and those who absolutely will not compromise their principles in trying to reach the ends.
Oh, well, that just jumps into one of the things we wanted to talk about today, which is the infighting within a certain organization or a certain community of somewhat like-minded people, but we disagree on certain things. And something I've been bringing up a lot on this program, and some of my listeners have been asking me, you know, what do I think? And it's a difficult conversation, but for those of us that are vegan, although that's not necessarily part of it, but I think it's an important part. For those of us that are against the exploitation primarily of animals, and we also realize the connection with people and the environment, the way to make change is not the same for all of us. And some believe that small steps will get us to the ultimate end, and some believe we just absolutely must be black and white and believe that everything that we preach has to be exactly what we believe in, and we cannot promote small steps on the way.
Right. Yeah. And I tend to be very open to all. I think that the dialogue is healthy. I think that the diversity is healthy. So I think that the whole picture is a wonderful thing, and I think if we could just approach each other as common cause rather than common enemies, we can really benefit from that dialogue. Rather than fighting with each other, we can spend our energy trying to bring change in the world. And yet we can still learn from one another by talking about different approaches and the pros and cons of different approaches. And there are pros and cons, and there are sacrifices that some make that others aren't willing to make. And just putting those on the table, understanding them, I think that's very important.
I'm with you there. I know that I know what I can do personally, and I know what I can promote personally. But if someone wants to do it a little differently, I don't want to condemn them. I don't think that's productive. And I'm not a promoter of Facebook. I use it. It's constantly changing, and I don't know that it's going in the right direction, but there's so much negativity up there, and it just upsets me when I see people that I believe want the ultimate, have the same goal in the end, are really putting each other down, getting there.
Yes, and spending a lot of time doing it.
And spending
time
a lot
be spent,
of time.
You could really do things with that time. I could write entire books with the time I see people wasting.
Yes,
arguing
it looks like
with
that's
each other.
What you're doing, yeah.
Well, and I don't go on Facebook. I don't engage in those kind of lengthy, time-consuming discussions. I know that they're out there, but that isn't where I want my energy to go.
Yeah, I like Facebook for posting family pictures for my family and seeing their pictures. It's just a fun place to unwind, to see some cute pictures, and I like posting recipes, friendly, happy things for people who, you know, want to unwind and see some nice things like that. But the negativity, it's not the place for it. I don't think any place is a place for it. But
it's a really good place to where people can find you, and I'm very fortunate. I have a wonderful student who's graduated and gone on to do wonderful things in social justice named Morgan, was Hanley and now Burnett, who actually keeps me a page on Facebook, so I can be found there.
Exactly.
But I don't have to deal with it, so I feel very fortunate about
yes,
that.
Yes, it's a good place to be found. I think I might have found you there, actually. I'm not
there
sure
you go.
Where I found you, but I know.
Thanks, Morgan. Yeah.
So dialogue is important. And so how do we do that? How, when someone is angry, and is there a way to dialogue so that anger is dissipated, especially when we're on the same path?
I'm comparatively old in this movement now, and one thing I've learned is save your energy. There are some people worth talking to and some that you should give a pass. Everybody is not worth talking to. Now, of course, when I was younger, everybody was worth talking to, and you have the energy, and to some extent, you have more time.
Right.
So now I know that if someone is not interested in the dialogue, if they simply, if you can see that they have a very set way of being or they don't invite conversation, they have to invite me into a conversation, and then I will have the conversation. But if they're just taking a stand, I will just acknowledge their stand.
Yes, and then
I sometimes won't even bother to say my own, because
what
is the point if they're not interested?
Very good, very good. All right, so you let me know that you're working. You've got a bunch of books coming out.
I do two anthologies and one that I've written called Eating Earth that looks at one of the social justice issues. And the environmental aspects of our dietary choice.
Okay, we've talked a bit about that on this program. Do you want to touch on, did you make some discoveries in this book? Or
what I like best about this book?
Yeah.
I don't know, discovery is the combination of things that are in it. It is not just on factory farming and the environment, which there is some coverage on. There is a whole chapter on that, and it goes in depth and basically points out very clearly our diet is the number one contributor to environmental degradation on, you know, at least five different areas, everything from the global climate change to deforestation to the water depletion to soil erosion, all of those. It's the number one contributor. But the book also has a whole chapter on fish, on fishing in seas and water. So another aspect of our dietary choice. And finally, hunting. It really looks closely at, so some people will quickly turn to fish or to hunting to try to say, oh, this is the better choice. And the book shows clearly that neither of those are better choices. The better choice is to quit eating animals. That is the only reasonable choice if you actually care about the environment.
That's good. Well, I look forward to reading that. And when does that come out?
October.
Okay, well, I didn't even, or maybe I knew it when I first reached out to you. I didn't know it.
I didn't know it, so that's why you didn't know it. It's not. I don't think I've put it out anywhere yet. It's not even on my current resume.
Does it have a title?
Yes, Eating Earth.
Eating Earth.
After the colon, I think it's Dietary Choice and Planetary Health or something really like that.
Great. Well, all the best. Now, how do you write 3 books at a time?
Yeah, well, it's an excellent choice because I'm also teaching, you know, a full-time job. So I think it happens that way. Well, it certainly happens that way unintentionally. I'll start something, and then, the other two are anthologies. So while I'm waiting for the essays to come in, I can't seem to contain myself, and I'll start something else, and the essays will pile in, and then I'll send those essays back, and I'll start something else. So they kind of slowly crawl along together. And one of them I started at least 6 years ago, maybe 7. It just takes a long time to put them together. So I don't know. I need different things to work on so I don't go nuts, and sometimes there's a lull in the activity, and I don't seem to have a lot of sense about doing something other than my work during those lulls.
Well, I think that this is where the small steps really make a difference in getting to your goal. There are some big issues where I'd like to see big, giant steps immediately, like end factory farming, done. In terms of accomplishing things in our life, small steps, working on everything in small doses is the way to ultimately reach our goals.
And, you know, one thing, when you say the conversation, talking to people and bringing change and dealing with others in the movement, that's one of the things that I always turn back to. One of my good friends who works for HSUS, Alex Burry, brought it up to me initially. She said, these people who say there's only one way and it's the right way, what I want to ask is, what are you doing?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, maybe there is only one way and only one right way. Good. What are you doing to get us there? So just attacking others in the movement isn't it. So there's so many different little ways and little steps. But I think it is true that there's a significant number, and I could name a few but will not, who simply spend their time attacking the work of others and, frankly, don't seem to be doing anything to actually change the ones who are consuming animals and exploiting them in other ways.
That's a great question to ask anyone, and I use that from time to time on a lot of different issues, not just with animal-related issues, because there's so much violence going on in the world today. And
absolutely.
What a lot of people do, I get these emails that were forwarded and forwarded and forwarded and forwarded and forwarded.
Yes.
And then I don't even have time to read them, but, you know, occasionally when I glance at one, they're just filled with so much vile hatred. And, you know, and I think, okay, what are you doing about it? Sending an email? That's not doing anything.
Yes. And there's one, I ask it with racism, with sexism, with homophobia, with ageism, with ableism. All of those are the same thing that... and it's pretty sketchy what people actually, when it actually comes to engaging with these, what they're willing to give up, what they're willing to admit, it shrinks considerably.
What they're willing to give up, exactly.
Yeah, yes, that's right.
Nothing.
And that's what it comes down to if you really care about social justice. You have to give up your privileges.
Yes, not all of them, just, you know, a little bit here and there.
That's right. And the ones you give up, you should never have had, and you shouldn't want them. So at the end of the day, it doesn't feel like a sacrifice. It just feels like what's right.
Gosh, it should feel good,
I
think.
Yes, that's right. It's like changing our diets.
Now, you're going to the conference in Luxembourg next week, and I've read a little bit about that. I actually... I was trying to bring a little bit of that conference here by interviewing a number of different people who are going to that conference. I had Friedrich Mühlen on the show and Frederica Schmitz.
Wonderful.
And so have you been to their conferences over there before?
Yes.
And what are they like?
They're really fun. First of all, it's just wonderful to go to Europe where you actually, I mean, our country is so gigantic. And it's
I love
kind
Europe.
Of,
mm-hmm.
Yes, it's nice to have different languages and just some different history, some very different history. So it's fun to go for that. But the conferences are wonderful, and there's a different flavor to them. And it's been a few years since I went to this particular one, but it had a very liberationist feel, which I really liked. And I do a lot of academic conferences, and they tend to be less liberationist, so I find that very... refreshing.
Okay, I got that. Now, I haven't been in Europe for 5 years. I can't believe it's that long that I haven't been there. And I used to live in France for 4 years when I never met another vegetarian in the early 90s. And it's so exciting now that they're out of the closet.
Yes. and it's taken off, too. It's totally taken off, and not just vegetarian, but vegan. It's out there. It's happening.
Yeah, but I got the impression it was more serious, and maybe that's changed, too.
What an interesting thought. Well, you know, there are flavors to countries, and the Brits have one of my favorite senses of humor anywhere on the planet. So, you know, I hate... Having said that, okay, they may be serious in some ways, but they have a great sense of humor. Now, France, well, okay, maybe they're more serious, but the dogs can go right into the restaurant. So, you know, really, who's a little more lighthearted there? The dogs are everywhere and right in the restaurants. They can go into grocery stores. They can go anywhere.
Right.
So, I don't know. It depends on what you mean, I guess.
Right. Well, I remember going to one of the early veggie pride parades in Paris, and we have one here in New York City. And it's a very different feeling here in New York. It's more just fun and festive. And I don't know if it's changed over there in Europe, but it was all of the dark issues. And it is dark. I mean, it's just horrible what humans will do, not only to humans, but to animals. And they wanted to bring all of that out.
And they tend to wear dark clothes there and be much more...
They do.
The word I would use, much more formal.
We wear a lot of dark clothes here.
Yeah, but we're not very formal. We're a younger nation that's a little bit savage in our ways, and you could feel that difference when you're there. There's a formality to life that we lack.
Well, I just feel it's almost like a load has been lifted, knowing that this dialogue is going on in Europe, and it's going on all over the world, where it didn't feel like it was before. Just gives me a lot of inspiration.
You know what else I love about it? It isn't just a dialogue anymore about animal rights. It truly is. I'm speaking on the juncture with sexism, with environment, and then in a conference in Germany at the end of my trip there, it's on religions. So three different intersections, and the one in Bonn, Germany, is completely on religion and animals. So we just, our scope is so much bigger in what we're looking at. We have some actual nuance now that is growing and strong.
Well, you work against oppression, and it's all the same. And when people get to that point where they see exploitation, just generic exploitation, just how we just take advantage of whomever, whatever we can, without any thought about it, when you see that, it makes it, I think, a lot easier to make change in your own life. And unfortunately, people need to go step by step. They only see it in one area before they see it in another area. But I think now we're starting to connect more dots.
Yeah, I think we are too. And I think as a Caucasian, I need to have sensitivity when I think about these subjects. So I think, what would, say, a black female lesbian say about that? What is her take on how these fit together? And then looking at the animals themselves, if they were speaking our language to us, what they would say about oppression, where they are, you know, systematically killed. So, okay, as a female, I know I meet up with discrimination. But to compare that to what happens to a pig, or, say, a black feminist lesbian, it's just a really different picture of what the experiences are. And I think just trying to be aware of that, and I don't know how much we can understand the experiences of others, but we can certainly listen and try to be sensitive to those differences.
One of the things that's challenging is language, and, you know, I've learned the hard way, putting my foot in my mouth from time to time over the decades, where it's like, that was not the right thing to say. But
heavens.
You know, sometimes you don't know until you say it and see what the reaction is, and then the light goes on. And there's so much that's in our language that is just normal. I mean, normal is not a good word, but...
I hear you, though.
And you don't realize what damage you're doing to someone else by saying certain things that are just so common.
Everyone does it. We all make mistakes. We cannot have full awareness of the experiences of others. And I think we need to apologize, and when we're offended, we need to accept apologies. I think that no one is completely clean, and if we're going to work together, we have to be able to accept our mistakes and be forgiving of others.
I sure would like to hear what animals think about what we do to them. I mean, you mentioned, you know, you don't know what they think or what they would say, but I would sure like to know.
We got some pretty good guesses about a few things they'd say.
Yeah. Now, the animals and religion, can you give us some idea of what you'll be talking about or discussing? That part is really fascinating. The whole religious, I'm not a religious person. And for those that are religious, I respect them as long as they're not causing pain and suffering to anyone.
Right. It's a great question you ask.
Yeah.
You know, the religion side of things is neglected, and most of the people in the movement will say they aren't religious. But what makes me sad is that they're saying that as if, therefore, that's why they don't know anything about it. And the reason I write about it is because it is one of the most effective ways to bring change. When I'm dealing with someone who is an atheist, let's say, they can, and I tell them all the horrible things that are going on, they can simply say to me, "Oh, gosh, that's horrible. Get out of my way. I'm trying to buy my groceries." But when you say that to someone from any one of the major religious traditions, they cannot say that. They are, if they take their religion seriously, they are bound to what's in their texts and their core teachings and the religious exemplars. They're tied to that. And when you call them on it, it has a very different effect than it can ever have on someone who is not committed to some moral code like that that they are tied to. So it's an extremely effective form of advocacy. But to use it, we have to actually know the traditions. So I would say the movement is remiss in not knowing these basic teachings and in not taking them on board so that when they meet someone, and I will almost never fail to talk to someone who's religious about these issues, because you know, I say I won't talk to people who are closed. They cannot be closed. They cannot tell me that their religion teaches cruelty or that their religion believes that causing unnecessary suffering is okay. So it's a very important field, and I encourage everyone out there, know the basics, know the fundamentals of religions that will call people to a kinder way of life.
Yeah, I like that. I was raised Jewish, and one of the things that I like to do, I love family gatherings and traditional foods, people getting together. That part of, be it religion or culture or whatever, holidays are great. And one of the things that I do is veganize all the recipes. And this year I did a vegan gefilte fish, and I can't wait for the Passover holiday to come around again.
Good for you.
Cause this
food
is
advocacy.
I haven't seen one of those before, except I make it out of almonds, and almonds are not very politically correct these days because they're coming from drought lands in California, and almonds are getting a rap, but...
That's okay. Walnuts have the omega-3s that we need anyway, so...
I'm not down on almonds. It's just I'm reading so many blog posts about people that are upset about almonds, and what do they want us to do, drink milk, cow's milk?
Yeah. Isn't it so true that it is hard, you cannot please everyone, but by golly, that is no excuse not to try and to make the changes you really need to make against the most horrendous things we're doing.
So back to religion, and that, so the tactic is to speak to religious people and bring up the parts of their religion that have to do with compassion.
Yep, and that's all that I do in animals and world religion. It goes through each religion and explores the animal-friendly teachings. And this isn't to say that I'm looking at some fringe element. These are core teachings. These are foundational teachings. These are teachings that no one in the tradition can ignore. And it also shows at the end of each chapter I give contemporary activists working in those traditions to bring change for animals because they know it's part of their tradition.
Mm-hmm. Now, we have the Jewish Vegetarians of North America, and we have the Christian Vegetarian Association. Mm-hmm. Do you know of any Muslim vegetarian society?
Yes, there is.
Oh, I've been looking.
Islamic Concern is, I think, what it's called. And, you know, many of the organizations, I think both PETA and HSUS, now have a link where you can click and find out about religious organizations working with animals, and Islam is one of the ones, I think, on both sites. But I also mention them in the book Animals and World Religion, so... I'm not real sure, but I can certainly look it up if somebody gets a hold of me and asks. Or you can also go on the web and find these things, but I think it's Islamic Concern.
Okay. I looked a few years ago and didn't find anything, so I think it's time to look again.
Yeah, and it is changing. It's a growing and changing field.
Yeah, which is very exciting. We're moving forward.
It's encouraging. And, you know, you've been in this long enough to know just how discouraging it could be.
Yeah. Yes, I do. So you're in Montana.
Yeah, talk about discouraging.
And there is a vegan restaurant, isn't there? If not more than one.
Well, there's certainly not one where I live in Billings, Montana, and it's the biggest city.
There isn't one.
There's not even a vegetarian restaurant.
Oh.
No,
okay.
No, this is Billings, Montana. Now, it's possible that Missoula, I doubt
it was
very
Missoula.
Much.
Missoula, yeah. How
yeah,
far
Yeah, they
away
might have a
that?
Vegetarian one. 5 hours drive.
Oh,
six.
Yeah, it's a big state.
Anyway, big state. Yeah. Yeah, a lot of difference between Billings and, yeah.
Okay, so it's not North very veg-friendly there.
Well, you know, it's changing. It is definitely changing. I've now been here more than a decade, and I have 35 students per class. I probably have every semester about 100, 120 students, and there is no class where I don't cover all of these facets of animal exploitation. And it's been long enough. There's change. I can see it when I go grocery shopping. There's a new grocery store downtown, and it actually has all of the vegan products. It's so exciting. It just
yeah.
opened. So
wow.
more and more I'm seeing that there's a sensitivity to the fact that there is a market for these things here in Billings, Montana.
That's so good. Now, do your students know what they're getting when they sign up for your classes?
I'm sure some of them do.
Do you surprise some of them with the information that you teach?
Of course I do, and especially early on before I had a reputation. I had one guy come in and sit down and say, I can't wait to get to the animal part. He could not wait. He was one of the exploiters. By the time we got to the animal part, he knew he had nothing to say because I built a platform in which he could not. He knew
oh, did
there was
he
no
think,
wiggle room.
Did he think he was going to have a debate with you?
Yeah, and he thought he was going to show me how wrong I was, and he just
wow.
lost his oomph as time went on.
This is the power of education. And we need it everywhere.
And it's so exciting. You know, the people know the degrees. There's actually animal studies programs. It's so exciting.
Say
there's
that
scholars
again. What,
studying this. There's now the education, yes, just as activists, we all need it. But it's also true that there's now degrees in animal studies, and there's courses in animal
degrees.
Studies.
Right.
Yeah, so we'll have more and more teachers out there who know this stuff, and their students aren't going to slip through without hearing it.
Yeah, and it's going to be good for animals, but it's going to be good for the environment. It's going to be good for people.
Yeah.
I continually yeah. think, you know, you mentioned people spending energy, too much energy on Facebook, and I think mm-hmm. we are capable of so much greatness, and we are
yes.
wasting our time.
And I swear our culture encourages us or wants us to.
To waste our time.
Yes, to not be.
I mean,
we're not causing trouble when we're playing on Facebook.
We could be accomplishing things that aren't even imaginable because we haven't mm-hmm. gotten to that place, but we could. I mean, just thinking of what we've done in the last 50 years is amazing, and the next 10 mm-hmm. are going mm-hmm. to be incredible if well.
I really want to tell young people, put your gadgets down. Be in the real world. Talk to people who are present. And I know that the Internet gives us lots of ability to have information and to connect with others far away. And some of my friends say, you know, it would be easier for you to be in Billings if you would connect with other vegans all around the world. And I know it's true, but I'm here connecting with the people in Billings, and it's how I bring change. And, yes, sometimes it's depressing and lonely, and I sometimes do need to and will connect with people outside and with my vegan friends elsewhere. But I just think we spend much too much time on just not dealing with real people in our real space, having our own real lives. And I don't think that's helpful to our movement.
I agree, and hopefully it's going to change. But Lisa, thank you for spending this half hour with me. I really enjoyed it, and I hope to get to meet you sometime. And I'm looking forward to Eating Earth. That's going to be a great book. I know it.
Thank you, and thank you for all the good that you do, and wonderful to talk with you.
Okay, and say guten Tag to everyone in Luxembourg when you get there.
Shall do.
Okay.
Will do. Take care.
Thank you. All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Well, that was great. That was Lisa Kimmerer, and we're going to take a little break now and be back with the Esselstyns, Dr. Esselstyn, Ann Esselstyn, and their daughter Jane, talking about the Prevent and Reverse Heart Disease cookbook. Stay with me. Hello, everybody. We're back. I'm Karen Hartglass. You're listening to It's All About Food here on September 2nd, 2014. and I want to bring on my next guest. We've got the Esselstyns talking about the new Prevent and Reverse Heart Disease Cookbook. So, who have I got there?
You've got Jane and Anne, and I believe my dad's on the phone as well.
Okay, so you're Jane.
I'm Jane.
Okay, I'm trying.
And Anne.
And Anne, I'm trying to differentiate the sound of the different voices. And Dr. Esselstyn, there he is.
You can tell him.
I can, that resonant baritone voice. How are you all doing?
Great.
Oh, we're great.
Okay.
Well, we've been reading about Amazing You.
Amazing, amazing me.
Yes.
Well, thanks for reading. You know, Anne and Dr. Esselstyn, I met you about 10 years ago. When I was executive director of Earth Save International, I had you come out and speak to my chapters here in New York, and people are still talking about it. You were both so wonderful and made a big difference in a lot of people's lives, so thank you for that.
Thank you.
And you continue to be amazing, so let's have an amazing half hour, shall we?
Great.
Okay, so you've got this great cookbook with lots of easy ways to get people healthy, and it's a continuation of Dr. Esselstyn's wonderful book, Prevent and Reverse Heart Disease. This is all good news, and more people are getting it, but unfortunately not everyone is getting it.
True.
And this is the frustrating part. So I just want to talk briefly about some of the things going on in the world today, and then maybe we can get into the delicious recipes you've got going to inspire people to do what is so easy and wonderful and good for us. Number one, Dr. Esselstyn, you were part of Bill Clinton's move to a healthier diet, and that made a lot of press, and that was really exciting. But he's kind of gone... He's not following your recipe exactly. He's going, Dr. Mark Hyman is recommending fish and eggs, saying he can't get quality protein with plant foods. How do you feel about that?
Well, I would respectfully disagree.
Oh, good.
Yeah, I think that it's, I think the data are really quite clear that animal protein as a dimension of injury to that life jacket and guardian of our blood vessels, which happens to be that single layer thick, delicate innermost lining called the endothelium. And the endothelium manufactures that absolutely marvelous molecule of gas for all of us called nitric oxide. And nitric oxide is our great savior. But anybody who has cardiovascular disease, whether they've had a stroke or a heart attack, the reason they have it in the first place is they have so successfully over the preceding decades progressively trashed and injured their endothelial carpet that they no longer have sufficient nitric oxide to really protect themselves. And also there's remarkable separate venue of research from the Cleveland Clinic by Stan Hazen and his team that clearly shows that in people who are eating, who are omnivores or eating meat, possess the type of intestinal bacterial flora that can metabolize those products into a very aggressive vascular disease causing molecule called TMAO.
Oh, I loved that research when it came out.
So that's my comment on.
Okay. Yeah, you know,
Clinton's
unfortunately,
change.
People are always looking for a reason to eat animals, and you know, some doctors give them reasons, whether they're justified or not, unfortunately. And then the other thing is you probably know the two articles on salt that just came out in the New England Journal of Medicine that were completely contradictory, driving everybody crazy. One said we need between 3,000 and 6,000 milligrams of salt, and the other one said we should get under 2,000.
The body has a way of remarkably preserving sodium in people's kidneys. And really, you're going to probably get all the sodium you need with food. On the other hand, if your food is cooked without any salt and you think it's a little flat with flavor, there's absolutely no harm in sprinkling using a salt shaker for a little added salt. You're not going to get very much at all for that. But, I'm really not going to get involved in that wrestling match over sodium because that's really reduces it to what I would call, actually, my good friend Colin Campbell calls it reductionism.
Yes.
In other words, where you focus on one single small item.
Yes.
And really, the body, when you come right down to it, is a symphony of really hundreds and hundreds of thousands of reactions going on all at the same time. And when you think about people like the Okinawans, who have perhaps the longest, it's documented that they have the longest-lived citizens of anywhere else on the planet. And you just know that they're not sitting there every day counting and wrestling with their sodium. They're just eating it rather what we would call sensibly. If you got something that tastes good, it's not overloaded with salt, you're probably going to be quite safe.
Well, I really appreciate the fact that in this cookbook you did not include the calorie breakdown, the nutritional breakdown, and it's all part of what you just said. I don't know how anybody could sit down and prepare a meal thinking about the numbers of what they're getting and what they're not getting.
Eating has to be an absolutely joyous experience, and you don't want to eat with a calculator.
Right. Okay, so let's talk about the joyous experience here. Now, when did you all start eating this way?
I know I was just starting college when they started to eat this way, so they were probably...
April of 1984.
This is Jane speaking.
Well, and my dad.
Yeah, right, obviously. Yeah, so, Jane, what was your reaction when this happened?
Oh, I just got a phone call. I was talking to my brother, who was in high school.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's four of us within 4 years. And my brother, who was still home, said, Mommy and Daddy have changed the way we eat around here. Like, no meat, no dairy, no sugar, fat, oil, or salt.
No.
And I was like, when they first started, it was this big swath. They just started. And I just said, well, what are you guys eating then?
So what are you eating?
It was sort of befuddling at first, like it is for most people.
The amazing thing is, this is Ann.
Yes.
That they all went off to college, and they took our breakfast, which was oats, just without cooking them, you know, dry oats with alternative milk and whatever, and sort of spread that among their friends. And incredibly, all our children, all four, all our 10 grandchildren are all plant-based.
Mm.
It's wonderful. You know, no, they didn't grow up. They were nursed, and then they drank water.
Right. Well, that's the way it should be, and that's the way it's the most successful. And my heart goes out to people who want to change their diet, but people in their family, either their spouse or their children or their parents, give them a hard time and don't support them. So your whole family as a package is just a great model.
All right, thank you.
Yes. Okay, let's...
One of our nieces was abroad this summer, and she was arguing with a family, a very famous rock star and her family, about eating vegan. And and just the more she argued, she said, the more she became absolutely focused and convinced, and it was so cute to have a 15-year-old just fighting out there with people who were clueless.
Yes, clueless still.
Or no, they were defending what they thought was true for them.
So there are many people now that are using the word trend with this kind of eating, that it's very trendy. And we know that it's not trendy. In fact,
how can this be trendy? Because it's the same thing. You know, nothing's changed. It's been like this. How many years, Essie? 30. I mean, there's no trend.
Yeah, I've been doing it for almost 30 years myself.
Well, you know, it's so interesting. Last night we were watching a documentary about the, you remember the Iceman that was found in the glacier?
Yeah.
Maybe a decade or so ago? And they recently did some research on him in Europe, and my husband was watching this, and he's like, Jane, get over here. He's like, look, they found the Iceman had calcification in his arteries and that he was lactose intolerant, all from his DNA. And they said, you know what? We are not supposed to drink milk. I mean, no one past the age of weaning drinks milk. So lactose intolerant is not a disease. It's how we've always been. So that whole part of the equation is not trendy. It's pretty much, in the DNA.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that this guy was young and nice, hiking around this glacier for whatever reason, with heart disease. From his diet seemed quite interesting.
Yes.
So I'm trying to debunk the trend by saying for 5,000 years this has been the way.
And when people talk about the paleo diet too, which is just crazy because there's so many different variations of paleo and so many different variations, the ways you can cheat.
Yeah. You look on, I was just seeing paleo bread.
Yes.
So I think the thing that is pushing plant-based nutrition is that increasingly now there is really some pretty hard science coming out in cardiovascular disease, how it can be reversed, diabetes, how it can be reversed, obesity, how it can be reversed, and hypertension, how it can be reversed, just to name a few of those common chronic killing diseases that in truth never exist with plant-based nutrition.
What do we do, Dr. Esselstyn, with the doctors that don't know this or don't support it?
The interesting thing is that that takes a while, but for instance, tomorrow I'm giving grand rounds at a hospital in Akron, and increasingly in the past year I've had an opportunity to give cardiology grand rounds in Boston, in New York City, and over the last several years in 19 different academic institutions. So the word is out. And I think what really is going to crystallize this rapidly is that when you have large insurance situations like Kaiser Permanente on the West Coast and elsewhere, when they really tumble to this and get their constituents to begin to eat plant-based to protect them from having all these procedures such as stents and bypasses and angioplasty and all the drugs that are consumed for this disease, when they find that this disease, which is nothing more than a foodborne illness, cardiovascular disease, can be vanquished, their savings will be enormous, and then they'll be able to reduce their premiums, hopefully.
Well, that's the American capitalist way, isn't it? When it all comes down to the bottom line, that's how we're going to make
change. Another thing I think, and this is Anne, I think the patients in time are going to begin to show the doctors the magic of eating plant-based nutrition. And the doctors just, I mean, so often we hear from patients that my doctor can't, but what are you doing? I mean, I've never seen this before. And so I think there's a huge teaching possibility in those patients.
Yes. Now, let's move to delicious food. So I love the dedication. You mention all of my favorites, all the dark leafy green vegetables that make up my life. And I really...
Do you need to hear that dedication? He can give you that dedication right now. He can wrap it for you.
Okay, this book is dedicated to bok choy, Swiss chard, kale.
Essie, you've got to do it. Say it.
Oh, yes, okay.
Bok choy, Swiss chard, kale, collards, collard green, beet greens, mustard green, turnip greens, napa cabbage, Brussels sprouts, broccoli, cauliflower, cilantro, parsley, spinach, and arugula, and asparagus.
There you go.
Got that down. That's nice. We need to write some music to that now.
Well, you know, my favorite thing about we have the most wonderful Avery Publishing Company, and I just love that they put that idea so perfectly out there.
Mm-hmm.
In that dedication.
Well, I know dark leafy greens saved my life, and they're just a powerful food, and I have learned to just love them in so many ways.
And we have lots and lots of recipes in the book with greens incorporated in things like, you know, if you're making pizza, you can put cooked kale in the pizza sauce before you spread it on the first layer of pizza, and you don't even know it's there because the pasta sauce dominates. But
you can put kale in everything, including cake.
Yeah, and James.
including
How about
cake.
That kale cake with blueberry frosting? I wanted that on the cover.
I think that might take a little while for people to try that one, but kale goes with everything. And it should. Why not? I'm moving through this book here. So one of my favorites, I really love simplicity and when a little light goes on. So you grill pineapple rings.
Yes.
What a great idea that is.
They're amazingly sweet and it's just surprisingly delicious.
And putting that with a burger... So good.
So good.
So good. And
the
they
beet
fit
burger,
so
not the beef, but the beet. And that, you know, the cool thing is in the beet burger that they have got the whole beet and all the beet greens in them. I mean, they are just a powerhouse of nutrition.
Yeah.
And a little bit of hope behind that recipe is that my parents actually were served that beet burger with a grilled pineapple by three college students who were excited about eating a plant-based diet, and they had the chance to make a meal for my parents, and that's what they made. Isn't that amazing?
It is amazing, but, you know, it just takes a little openness.
Yeah.
And once
when we have guests, I think it's important to share with you that one of the favorite meals that I first tumbled to when I was really thinking about all this, and that is that it's so basically simple, and that's simply rice and beans, and then this tremendous variety of toppings that you can put on that, everything from cut up tomatoes, peas, and corn, water chestnuts, scallions, and then top it off with a delicious salsa or tamari, and you've got an absolute feast.
One of our favorite recipes in the book is Matt's
Sofrito
black beans with this incredible mango lime salsa. Oh, it is it's just gorgeous, delicious.
Okay, this is my favorite subject. I love talking about food. I love eating my food, and I love creating new food and reading cookbooks on plant foods. And it's just, I don't think there's anything better on the planet to do with your time. But so many people, unfortunately, don't cook, don't want to cook.
Well,
and what do we do with
cook.
Them? They should. Do we just try and help them learn to where their kitchen is?
What?
Do we just help them find their kitchens?
Well, I mean, I often point out the amount of time they have had to have their nails done or watch the 16 shows that they've just discussed with me or the tattoo of the Last Supper on their back that they had just printed up. I mean, they've got time.
Mm.
It's just the priority. Sometimes it takes a skillet to the head to get you into the kitchen. You know, something happens or you suddenly don't like the feeling or the shape or the size or the pathology of what's happening with your body. So for some people, it's like any change. They've got to have, it's got to, either some people are just off the cliff, some people make their way there.
Yeah, cooking, preparing food does affect your nails and how they look.
Well, you know what I think? I do think that young people today, and especially the males, are so much more into cooking than when, you know, I was...
Yes.
Was young.
Yeah.
And I mean, unfortunately, my husband isn't a cook. He's a fabulous dishwasher, which makes up. But, you know, our grandchildren, our older grandchildren are cooking, and that's cool.
Well, it really is important to find the kitchen and learn how to make a few meals, not just because it's good for you, because it is, but I think it also helps understand what goes into your food, know what you're eating. People don't even know what's in their food.
Oh. Yeah, I mean, that was Michael Pollan's recent book, The Cook, or what was it? It was his last book.
Yeah, I don't remember
just
the title.
Get in the Kitchen.
Mm-hmm. Just Get in the Kitchen.
I was like, right on, that he's right.
Now, what do you do when you are going out to eat?
What makes you think we go out to eat?
Well, okay, somebody travels in this family and is...
There are three reasons. There are three reasons to go out to eat.
Yes.
One is you don't have to do the dishes. Two is the ambiance, and three is the companionship. But you never ever go out to further destroy your endothelial cells.
No, but let me say that more and more you can get wonderful food when you go out, and we also have found that if we're going somewhere that's pretty a good place, if you call ahead, they will shock you with what they can create. So, and one of our favorite places is just the Curito Burrito at the Cleveland Airport, where we can get rice and beans and broccoli and, you know, corn and just a whole pile of good things.
that's right. So. As long as you know what to leave out, a burrito is an incredible food.
Well, I don't even get the bread. I just get it in a bowl.
Oh, there you go. Yeah, the fillings.
It's wonderful. I mean, I look forward to going to the airport.
Okay, now, one of the things you're known for in the prevent and reverse heart disease diet is the fats, no oils, and little or no nuts.
Well, the problem with the oils is that the oils, with actually some excellent peer-reviewed scientific publications, oils have been shown to injure endothelial cells. And we have seen it with patients when once we stop the oil, often we will see their chest pain rapidly begin to disappear. So we certainly don't want to have people consuming something that is going to injure, especially when you think about it, there is really no mineral in oil. There's no fiber in oil. Maybe a tiny bit of vitamin E, but other than that, all you're eating is fat, and then the fat is dangerous fat. Now, the other thing you mentioned was nuts, and here I'll confess to being guilty. When my patients have so injured their endothelial cell mass that they can't make enough nitric oxide to protect themselves, the actual additional saturated fat that comes from nuts is something I certainly definitely don't want them to have. And the problem with that is, how many people do you know who will eat one nut? In other words, if I ever said people could have one nut, that's not what they would hear. It would be Dr. Esselstyn said nuts are fine. So
and they'll open the can.
Apartment, they're in the workbench, they're in the bathroom, the bedroom, the kitchen, and everywhere. And they're in all kinds of food. So we have never felt guilty. I've never felt guilty in asking people not to.
But you know what? In our book, there are no nuts. Mm-hmm. There are no nuts. We are adhering to that guideline. No nuts in any of the sauces or dressings or recipes.
And I think
need them.
It really separates our book from everything that's out there today because oh my goodness, it's delicious, that 2/3 cup of cashews that will make a creamy sauce. But
we don't have that.
Mm-hmm. And you don't miss it. We have really amazing, amazing things without those nuts.
It always comes down to what are the outcomes? What are you getting for results? And we just published in July our results with some 200 patients, and of the 90% who were adherent to our program, these patients who were ill with advanced cardiovascular disease totally vanquished any recurrence of their disease in 99.4% of the patients over the next close to 4 years.
Wow.
And they did so by eating this way. So that's why we thought we had to write this book. we had to get more recipes out there because, honestly, we have gotten better and better and better with our recipes and our flavor profiles the longer we've eaten this way. And the only reason we can eat this way as a family of 20 people now is because
it tastes good.
It's easy. It tastes great. It's not a burden. It's loaded into our hard drives, into our minds, into our kitchens. But it's just so simple.
Yeah, well,
so
I know
doable.
That the people that can't, when you tell them to not eat animal foods, okay, that's like one step. What am I going to eat? I can't imagine not eating this, that, and the other thing. And then when you say no oil, a lot of people just freak out. What? No oil? But it's not hard to do, and the benefits. All benefits.
Well, we have got, and I think, a truly exciting chapter on, I don't even know how many salad dressings, because I think once you've figured out a salad dressing that you like, that has got no oil in it, you are set. I mean, first of all, just imagine the calories you're not having if you're thinking that way. But, that is just a triumph, I think, in this book. All are, just amazing variety of salad dressings.
The more I restrict from my diet, the more varied it becomes.
Woo-hoo! Well said.
which seems kind of counterintuitive, but it's so true. When I
eliminate because you open wide up to everything that's out there when you turn yourself the other way.
Hello, herbs and spices and vinegars, and it's just and all the fruits and vegetables.
Don't get my mom going on vinegar.
Oh my God,
she's like the acid queen. She's vinegar on everything.
The acid queen.
But we've discovered the flavored vinegars.
Yep, pretty good.
And they really they become the salt that you know that you
actually
could.
Sometimes aside from umeshiso vinegar, which is loaded with salt, vinegar can taste salty in a way when you're used to not having salt
or sweet or it occupies your tongue. Your tongue is happy when it gets a hit.
We've come to the end, and I really appreciate having the family here on the show today. You're all wonderful. Thank you so much.
Well, you've been wonderful.
You're wonderful. Thank you.
Oh, we're all wonderful. I'm going to go
out. I think
it's
how we eat.
Yes. Oh, I totally agree. When you love your food, you're just full of love.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay. Take care.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Thanks. Bye-bye. Well, that was the Esselstyns and Kyle Esselstyn, Dr. Caldwell Esselstyn, and their daughter Jane Esselstyn. And I'm Karen Hartglass. You've been listening to It's All About Food. Join me at responsibleeatingandliving.com. That's where I live. Send me an email at info@realmeals.org. And remember, have a delicious week.